Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for joining us once again on Queensberry Rules Radio. I'm Patrick Connor of QueensberryRules.com, and of course with me, like every single week without fail, is James Foley of BadLeftHook.com. James.
What's up, Patrick?
How are we, my friend?
We are good.
Good, man. Yeah.
We're real good.
Hell yeah, we're ready to roll. What's up?
I'm pretty good, man. I'm a bit somber about what happened this weekend.
You're not reinvigorated with.
Well, it was the death of a king, but maybe the rebirth of something else. I guess we'll see.
I mean, we have a brand new middleweight champion. What are you sad about?
It was exciting to watch, and I guess it kind of had to happen. And I'm glad it was Cotto. If somebody, one of the bigger guys, was going to kind of scalp that title from what looked like a pretty obviously diminished, physically version of Martinez, then I'm happy it was Cotto. And it looked like a great event. I mean, it looked like an awesome atmosphere.
That's a good point, actually, to
see a fighter who just looked like he was completely physically broken down. But, it's a gamble that we took,
Well, you did bring up a good point, though, and that's something that I hadn't even really thought a whole lot about, and I haven't heard too many people, say things. But I guess it's better to see Miguel Cotto do it than, some random middleweight that we'd never seen before step up and just totally smash through Sergio Martinez and what was supposed to have been a set up or keep busy fight or something like that. I guess it's better to actually see a high profile guy do it than that.
Yeah. We're going for bare minimums here. Well, do you want to hype up our boy? Is he about to jump on here? I told him to give us 2 minutes and 17 seconds.
Actually, I think that he was off by a couple, maybe 3 or 4 seconds, but he should be here right now. Mr. Raskin.
Hey, what's going on, guys?
Thank you so much for coming, sir. We appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's been far too long.
So how are you feeling about it?
No matter what happens on this podcast today, it will not be the highlight of my day because, as Foley already knows, I got a tweet favorited by Rosie Perez earlier today. So it's all happening for me.
Well, geez, I'm just going to have to start hashtagging my little tweets about this podcast with the old boxing heads hashtag then, right?
I guess I didn't even have a hashtag on there, so the Glazer myth that you need hashtags to get noticed has been debunked. I think Rosie was just searching her own name on Twitter and came across my snarky, sarcastic tweet celebrating the fact that she made a pick at the Cotto Martinez fight a few days ago, and I don't know whether she didn't get the sarcasm and was happy to see her name shouted out there or was starring the tweet to seem like she was in on the joke. But either way, favorited by Rosie Perez, the first lady of boxing. What more can you ask for?
Yeah, I remember I had tweeted out something about Caleb Truax a couple months ago, and Caleb Truax totally favorited my tweet, and I was wondering whether or not he got that I was, not being nice. But who knows?
Right. Caleb Truax and Rosie Perez are on approximately the same level of celebrity, I'd say.
Yeah. Well, in Minnesota, anyway.
Right. In the Truax household, they're neck and neck.
Yeah, in the Truax household, it's about the same level.
Right.
Well, hey, before we get into too much boxing stuff, I actually wanted to, if anybody listening isn't familiar with you, well, number one, they're fucking stupid. No, but if anybody is not familiar with Mr. Raskin, he contributes to ESPN, HBO, Grantland, and you also write for a, if I'm not mistaken, a poker website, or is it a, it's also a website and a magazine, I believe, right? All In?
Correct. Yeah, you're. I'm the editor of All In magazine, correct. That's my day job.
Very nice. Well, that kind of segs nicely into my next point, which was that you also have a newer book out called The Moneymaker Effect, which is, of course, about poker. In probably like 2006 or 2007, of course, I had started playing poker along with, I don't know, millions of other Americans. And I don't know, it was kind of a bit of a craze there for a few years. It seems to have died down now a little bit, but it's still popular. And I take it that your book probably talks about that being called The Moneymaker Effect, which was basically Chris Moneymaker winning the World Series of Poker in, what was it, 2003 or something
right.
like that? That in well, anyway, I figure I'll let you explain what the book's about.
Sure. No, I mean, well, listen, you are apparently a classic example of the Moneymaker Effect, one of the millions upon millions of people who you know, got hooked on poker to either a small or life-altering extent after Chris Moneymaker won the 2003 World Series of Poker main event. So, and that's really what the book is. It's a massive oral history of that tournament, the one that essentially launched the poker boom, where ESPN televised the entire tournament in depth with whole card cameras for the first time. Online poker was starting to boom, and then along comes this total unknown amateur with the perfect last name, amazing underdog story, who qualified for the tournament for $39 in an online satellite tournament, and 5 days of poker later, there he is with the $2.5 million first prize. So it just sort of created this sense that anyone can win, and the Moneymaker Effect, the title of the book, refers to the way that all these other amateurs around the world were inspired to kind of give poker a shot. I guess you it sounds like you never quite made multi-millions at the poker table, Patrick, but some people did,
really.
And this book, this book, you know, really focuses on that moment in time, sort of the essential tournament in the history of poker that created the whole poker explosion.
So, well, first of all, you said it's a massive oral history, and I'd like to point out that we really do enjoy massive oral here on Queensbury Rules Radio. But
should have gotten
poker?
A pause for that one, I guess, huh?
Yeah, I tried to, but I wanted
James
to let
Beck,
you
James Beck Jr. is pausing somewhere, wherever he is.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah. So why poker? What about poker that what really drew you in about it?
Well, you know, actually, it's funny. It's sort of like the way I got started in boxing, in that I took a job covering it and working as an editor. You know, in boxing, it was the case that my first job out of college was as an editor for The Ring. Before I was necessarily a huge fan of boxing or poker, I took those jobs and then became a fan. So I got very immersed in the poker world starting in 2005, and just it was clear to me that this was the event that was worth focusing on initially, and in a long-form article that I wrote for Grantland that I pitched to those guys to do the oral history there, and then realizing I just had so much more material that couldn't be fit into the article that I could expand it into this book as well.
That's pretty cool stuff, I have to say. I mean, you know, I made a couple bucks a few times playing poker, but I just don't have the patience to do a tournament-style play. If I go to a table, I might be able to pick up a few bucks, but nah, I definitely no World Series
like
of Poker in my future. What's that?
Oh, so you like to hit and run? You don't have
basically, yeah, and I might not even make money doing that. I might totally just get taken. I'm not that good. But yeah, it's fun stuff, and the history behind it is pretty interesting.
Right.
Sorry,
go ahead, Foley. Didn't mean to step on you.
No, I was just saying there is some cool history, because when I got into poker, you know, like 10 years ago or whatever, I mean, I read all the old, like some of the older books, like The Biggest Game in Town, which is by, like, I forget what the guy's name is, Alvarez.
Right.
And I think it was about like 1981, yeah, World Series. And there is some, actually some cool history with, you know, the tournament in its very primitive form when Las Vegas was kind of just becoming, you know, what it is today. But actually, Rafi, I wanted to ask you one.
That was when Bob Arum was in his 60s, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you one kind of like poker-specific question, not to get, you know, too, that might be more for the poker heads, but one interesting point I saw raised up, and probably related to your book or your Grantland article, I can't remember, but kind of about the 10th anniversary of the 2003 series. And like, I remember watching it and at the time and being immediately drawn, of course, because as a huge Houston Rockets fan, my boy Phil Ivey was wearing the iconic pinstripe Steve Francis jersey on
right.
that last day of the tournament. Do you remember that? And but aside from that, Ivey just had so much magnetism, and he was like the professional, you know, the young superstar. And of course, he had that famous hand with Moneymaker, you know, where he was knocked out in 10th place. Which I thought your oral history actually did a good job of kind of painting that, like, oh yeah, that actually wasn't that. Really that bad of a beat considering the way that it all played out, because it's kind of thought of as like Moneymaker sucked out on Ivy, even though, you know, the hand actually wasn't that, you know. But do you think it would have been better? The question was like, do you think, you know, if had Ivy's hand held up and Ivy gone to the final table with a huge stack and this guy who had this real star quality, you know, won the tournament as a professional, how would that have been different than, you know, Moneymaker, who obviously had the great, you know, amateur backstory and the name?
Right. Yeah, no, it's an interesting question, and one that certainly has come up, and a lot of people commented in the book, the people they interviewed, about how, you know, that hand maybe more than any other changed poker history. To me, Ivy's charisma is a little bit of a myth. I think he's so popular, you know, because he looks cool and he's young, and mostly
yeah.
though just because
it's not necessarily
he's it's not his personality.
He's a charismatic like presence at the table. It's
right,
really,
right.
You
it's
know,
intimidation
his
and just how good he is. It's like, you know, it's to compare it to boxing. There's a little bit of Floyd Mayweather there that you're buying the pay-per-view because you know you're watching the best in the world. So it would have been a very different kind of boom. I'm of the belief that poker was going to explode in 2003 with online poker and TV poker happening at the same time. It was going to grow, but the extent that it did and as rapidly as it did, tripling the number of players in the main event from one year to the next after normally it would grow like 10% or so each year to grow 300% in one year, I think that traces back to the amateur dream that Moneymaker fulfilled. So even if Ivy had won, it still would have been good for poker, but I don't think it would have been as big as Moneymaker made it.
And then, you know, yeah, next thing you know, you have guys looking like Ted Kaczynski all over ESPN, too, playing poker. You know, it's pretty crazy.
Right. That's what it's evolved
yeah.
into, is hoodies and sunglasses and a lot of people without much personality, unfortunately.
Well, yeah, the players have gotten better looking, but actually much to the detriment of the entertainment value
right.
of watching it.
Right. Fat old guys with unkempt hair and ass crack showing, that the old school stereotype is in a way a lot more fun to watch on TV.
Well,
I could just
and
watch bowling
if you think about
watch that.
But when we started watching it, you know, and you think about the guys like the, you know, these old grizzled guys with these crazy backstories, and half of them had been in jail and stuff like that. And you know, if poker's still around and being televised, which it probably will be, you know, 25 years from now, the players who are older then, it'll be like, yeah, I was going to Yale Law School and my, you know, I had, you know, $50,000 in my bank account and I've, you know, made millions of dollars playing online. It's like, it's not quite the same edge that there was to the
right, the old,
you know,
the old Texas
generation.
Road gamblers, yes, who had to
right,
bring a gun
right,
to the
right.
game. Yeah, a little bit different, but yeah, I know.
We'll always have boxing for that.
There you go. And speaking of, I assume your listeners probably wouldn't mind us shifting back into boxing mode. So I'll just quickly sneak in here that you can find the book on Amazon. If you're remotely interested in poker, I think you'll enjoy it. And, well, obviously, I think you'll enjoy it, but Foley may have a slightly more unbiased opinion, having not written it, but having at least started reading it. So,
yeah,
if you can, yeah,
it's great.
That's
it's great.
Cool
it's great. if you like poker,
I tweeted out a link.
You know, it is great.
Awesome.
I tweeted
Thanks
out a link, so hopefully people check it out.
Cool.
So,
all right, enough
shilling.
We can talk boxing now.
Well, then shifting into boxing, tell us what you think about our new middleweight champion.
You know, I'm still trying to totally make sense of what I saw on Saturday night and what it means in terms of the extent to which Miguel Cotto is back. It's a weird thing. You know, I was there at the Garden, which was great for the atmosphere perspective, but I don't think it gave me any additional insight into the fight. If anything, I saw the same fight, but I don't have any idea what the HBO guys were saying about it. This is a case where so much of what happened in that ring was dictated by what was wrong with Sergio Martinez. I think you just, as much as we'd love to celebrate Cotto and say this beloved warrior is, had this phenomenal defining victory and all that, there's an asterisk attached to it because Martinez, we didn't know this for sure coming in. In fact, I think most of people were picking a Martinez win, and therefore we were kind of under the impression that he was going to be close enough to 100% health. But it just became very obvious very early that something was wrong, whether it was that his knees weren't cooperating, his chin is kind of shot, a little bit of both. He's just kind of old and reflexes slowing down. More than anything, it seems to me that it's the knee issue and the fact that his legs just weren't under him totally. So I hate to diminish Cotto's win, but I think you kind of have to. He's the legit middleweight champion of the world. There's no question about it. Everybody else is a belt holder. He is the champion. I need to see him again against another elite guy before I can even begin to consider him the best middleweight in the world right now.
And that's I think something that a lot of people just in general, I mean, this is part of what's wrong with boxing, although it's not something new, that somebody could be the champion, the one champion in the division, but not be the best guy in the division. That doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. I mean, that happens in boxing, right or wrong, no matter what. But it seems to be happening more now with more belts and everything, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that's something. I'm reluctant because I do want to give Miguel Cotto a lot of credit as a fan, but I don't think that there's any way anyone can convince me that was a decent looking Sergio Martinez in there. He didn't look good.
No, I mean, he basically fell apart the first time he was hit and tried hard, showed a lot of effort, a lot of guts to, showed, as I said on Twitter, showed a lot of balls, maybe not quite as much as Cotto showed on 24/7, but still showed a lot of balls. But, yeah, it was just there to be taken that night. Cotto was the right guy in the right place at the right time. With the right level of ability and a good game plan, and you know Freddie Roach seems to have injected a little new life into Cotto. He's got some bounce in his step. He's looked great these last two fights, but again, they're against Delvin Rodriguez, who's not an A-level guy, and Sergio Martinez, who, as best I could tell, was not an A-level guy on Saturday night, and wasn't in his previous fight against Martin Murray either. And you know, maybe we were hopeful that we could ignore that and that wouldn't be the Sergio we'd see against Cotto, but it was. Essentially, he's done. And so, yeah, you know, all these opponents they're talking about for Cotto next in terms of, like, big-name opponents we'd love to see him in with, whether it's a Floyd rematch, a Canelo fight, or a Golovkin fight, any of those three guys are going to tell us whether Cotto has turned some corner and is somehow better than ever at age 33, or whether he's still the same guy who is a top fighter who falls short against his best opponents, against the elite guys. I mean, how many people have out of 100 right now would pick Cotto to beat Golovkin? Probably less than 10, I would think.
Brian Perez, maybe.
Brian Perez would probably pick him. You know, there was a lot of talk at the fight during the before the fight started. I managed to grab a couple of drinks with some other some of our friends in the boxing media, and there was a lot of talk about just how short Brian Perez is in real life that nobody was prepared for. Our friend Brian Campbell jumped in and was like, "He's like 4'10". And to which everyone else pointed out Campbell was perhaps exaggerating slightly, but was something more like 5'5 or 5'6, something like that. Still, a height that you wouldn't necessarily have realized just watching him on 24/7. So
there's my Brian Perez insight. But hold on. I'm just imagining this in my mind's eye now, and what I'm imagining is Brian Campbell saying that, but saying it in like 80s metal sing song, so he's like, because I've heard that he is like an air band expert.
Yeah, that's exactly how it went down, actually, now that you mention it.
Okay, just making sure. I'm figuring he's listening too, so that was pretty much just for him.
Right.
You know, that it was really shocking, needless to say, in the first round. As soon as Sergio Martinez was hurt, I was like, whoa, shit, it's like that. I think that the prevailing opinion for a lot of people, myself included, was that even if Sergio Martinez was not 100%, even if he was 50%, I think the prevailing opinion was that even if that were the case, that he probably hit hard enough that Cotto's chin wasn't going to withstand it. And it was almost every single thing we expected to happen didn't happen, and the exact opposite happened. You know, to me, the knockdowns in the first round, or at least I think it was the first two, neither of them were super clean. Sergio definitely looked like he had, leg issues, or as soon as he got hit and hurt, that was kind of it. But the really surprising thing to me was that Miguel Cotto was like a Sherman tank. He couldn't be stopped in there. There was nothing that Martinez could do to really like stave him off aside from really like running, you know, moving around a lot.
Right.
Why?
I think a lot of that
really
has
Freddie
to do
Roach
with,
or?
No, I don't see how Freddie Roach is going to improve Miguel Cotto's chin. Not that Cotto has a bad chin, but he also, you know, is not known for having a great chin. I think it comes down to the assumption we're all making that Sergio's knees were messed up. And if you can't plant and you can't really put your weight behind your punches, you know, not that Sergio landed that cleanly that often. He had a few good jabs and dropped in his straight left a few times, but like I said, it did nothing. I think it's because he just couldn't plan and get his whole weight behind it. I don't know that I would agree that a 50% Martinez had any chance of winning that fight. The whole percentage thing is a little weird because how the hell do you ever actually measure that?
Well,
but my sort of thinking
of
going into the fight was, 90% Sergio is enough to get it done. We start talking 80, 75%, maybe not. Maybe we've got a real war on our hands if that's the case. But I think we probably did get something close to 50%, in which case it's Cotto just dominating him all over the ring. And, if that was why I thought the stoppage at the time that they stopped it was a good idea, because not only was he starting to take a beating in that ninth round, but it became really obvious that round he no longer had the puncher's chance. There was no sense sending him back out there because he couldn't hurt Cotto. He couldn't position himself to land his big bomb. So at that point, you say, what's the point? Stop the fight. Save the guy. And I thought his corner did a good job calling it off at the right time.
Yeah, there really wasn't any controversy about him, or the corner not letting him continue, which is kind of odd. There's always some fringe element that, seems to criticize every any decision to stop a fight. But I think this one's been, roundly applauded for good reason. But, another interesting, side element of this is it kind of, obviously we all agree that the alphabet titles are basically a joke, but a situation like this kind of shows that even some of the lineal championships, because you know, it's not rankings that are making fights. It's boxing politics. And so did Cotto do anything to really push himself up into, like, a number one contender position in middleweight to even get this fight? Of course not. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't. I mean, look, he beat the guy. And Martinez had defended against a top contender the last time out against Martin Murray. But at a certain point, you know, like, if just to make the tennis metaphor, you know, Rafael Nadal wins the French Open. He doesn't get to, like, you know, wait 18 months. He has to be back there 1 year later to play against everyone, you know, every ranked opponent that gets there to play against him. And he has to, you know, to defend that championship, you have to win. And so I think an interesting question going forward is, do we just respect the lineage and now Cotto gets to fight basically whoever he wants at 155 or above with the lineal middleweight title at stake? Or if he should fight a Canelo and then the winner of that fights Mayweather, I mean, at what point do we say, okay, these guys are good fighters, but Golovkin's been the number one contender at middleweight for a year? And, I mean, personally, I feel like you can, you know, if that doesn't happen, sometime within a reasonable amount of time, it's acceptable to basically vacate the lineal title and put it up for grabs among real middleweight contenders. Because, you know, Cotto was lucky that, you know, he had the muscle to make this fight happen, and he's the one who got this crack. But I think you guys would agree there's a lot of fighters from 154 to 160 who could have beaten that version of Martinez on Saturday night.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think just about any top 10 middleweight or junior middleweight with a little bit of pop could have beaten him. You know, again, assuming...
Andy Lee might have beaten him on Saturday night.
Yeah, hey, Andy Lee with that punch could have dropped a lot of guys, I guess. The lineal titles, it's still a flawed system. It's the best system boxing has, but you're right. It's not as good as tennis, where in the sense of determining a true champion, it's not as good as anything where there's like a tournament every year that determines the champ. But you just can't do that in boxing because, you know, you can only fight so many times a year. It's the best system we have, but it is a flawed system. The argument has always been that in boxing, the marketplace will ultimately dictate the fights, and if a guy is the top contender long enough and the fans demand it, it'll eventually happen. And I'd like to believe that's going to be the case with Golovkin. That at this point, I wouldn't say like Golovkin is overdue for his shot. He's just kind of due for it at this point. But if this goes on for another year or two.
I mean, if he destroys Gil, it's tough to make an argument. Like, okay, now he's got to fight Soliman.
Right.
And now he's
right.
Got to fight.
No, I mean,
like, come on. Like, at some point, you got to be like, hey, he's destroying these guys on the second tier. It's time. You know, it's time. I mean, I just think that, like, my main point going away is that I think that the custodians of lineage have to enforce the same types of rules that you would have as a normal champion. And if you're not fighting the top contender, then, you know, because this has a potential to be really gimmicky if this fight happens with Canelo and the winner of that fight's Mayweather at some point, you know, and knowing boxing, this could end up getting pushed back to like September of next year. And then
right.
The lineal middleweight championships at stake at 155 catchweight with these weird fights between like guys from 154 and 147. It's just not right. You know?
No, I agree that it's definitely flawed. I think you get into a lot more trouble though, if you start suggesting stripping titles, that you know that's how we got in the alphabet mess in the first place. So I don't think anyone who is a historian of the lineage, I don't think it's right for them to say at a certain point these guys are all ducking Golovkin. I'm stripping them in my mind of the title. First of all, what does that accomplish? I guess, but it also just opens up a can of worms. Yeah, I'll note for the record that James Foley has already stripped Miguel Cotto of his title and declared the middleweight title vacant. So you know, you're on record with that, I suppose.
That's not all he stripped him of after that 24/7, I'll tell you that much.
Hey now.
Boom. You know, we were talking about this last week in particular, but, you know, of course, my opinion got called asinine. That was fun. But we were talking about the fact that, you know, basically the next fight, the most likely thing to happen is that Miguel Cotto, who is essentially a junior middleweight and a small junior middleweight at that, is going to defend the middleweight title probably against another junior middleweight, if not a welterweight, parading around as a junior middleweight that's put on a few pounds. You know what I mean? So whatever you want to say about that being wrong or not right, it's just weird. And it seems like it's a perfect example of a fighter being able to essentially, I guess, play the system in order to – I mean, it's so weird, and it's kind of basically what you two were just talking about with the whole lineal versus alphabet thing. It's basically just a demonstration that even with the lineal title, things can kind of get manipulated a little bit, and that there are always going to be asterisks. And it's so strange how these questions can't just be straightforward with, like, who's the champion? You know, it should be just straightforward answer. Miguel Cotto's the champion.
Right. And he is. And in my mind, that's the way that I view it. He is, and it is straightforward if we ignore all the alphabet belts. But you're right. It's definitely we're entering into an uncomfortable situation here where – Right, we have not a non-middleweight, essentially, which also I guess Sergio Martinez was when he first claimed the title. Everyone sort of thought of him as a junior middleweight when he beat Kelly Pavlik, and then he settled into the middleweight division, but that's kind of beside the point. We're going to have a non-middleweight in Miguel Cotto defending against either a welterweight in Mayweather or a junior middleweight in Canelo, most likely in his first defense. And I think it was you guys on the show last week that used the term that Mayweather, if Cotto wins, Mayweather finds a way to backdoor into the middleweight title. I'll let you insert a pause there, Patrick.
Super pause.
But, you know, I think you guys used that term, and it's absolutely right that, you know, Mayweather, throughout Martinez's reign, didn't show any interest in making that move toward history to try to claim the middleweight title. Now that Cotto, a guy he's already beaten, has the title, it'll be very interesting to see if suddenly that's an easy fight for Mayweather to make and he's interested, although although it's also been pointed out that if he has to work with Top Rank to do that, then it certainly shines a light on the fact that he hasn't been willing to work with Top Rank to fight a certain other guy that they have in their stable. So all things considered, somehow it feels like Cotto Canelo is the more likely scenario for the fall. But look, those are huge fights, and they're going to make a ton of money for everybody involved, and you can't begrudge the fighters for making them. But you guys are both correct that it's a little uncomfortable, a little awkward, and poor Gennady Golovkin is just sitting there patiently knocking the shit out of guys waiting for a crack.
Yeah. Well, we don't know. I mean, I think Cotto Canelo is such a no-brainer, though, on so many different levels. And, you know, the Cotto beating Martinez, it completely validates that fight. You know, whereas before you could have said, well, Cotto hasn't really won at 154 in Canelo. But, you know, I mean, this now he's got a huge win. He's got the middleweight title. They can throw that angle into it. And then, of course, it has just so many other, you know, it's a classic crossroads fight. And you have Mexico, Puerto Rico. And it's just, it would be a huge event. And, you know, I'm not going to be the guy like waving the sign for Golovkin standing in front of that, you know, because I think that would be a great fight for boxing. It's just to act like we're really seeing like this prestigious middleweight championship being fought by the best possible contenders. It's just, you know, I mean, the other thing about Martinez is, and I love Sergio. I thought he was a great fighter at his best, and I think he has some good wins. I thought it was ridiculous when people were suggesting that, I mean, I hate to say it, I'll take maybe some heat again, but that Froch should be in the Hall of Fame ahead of Martinez, a guy who's never been the best fighter in his division. But, you know, I love Sergio, but over the past few years, I mean, he's fought once a year. And if you're the champion, you're fighting one time a year. Those are the best contenders, Chavez Jr. in 2012, and then Martin Murray last year, and then now Miguel Cotto. I mean, And a lot of this is because of Golovkin, because to me he has really separated himself from that pack. And even though, you know, he hasn't had really huge wins on paper, I mean, I think we all agree he's a class above those middleweights like Felix Sturm and Solomon and Gil and Barker and those guys. And the one fight he got against anybody with a name, I mean, he just destroyed him. You know, Matthew Macklin didn't belong in the same ring with him. And
right.
That's part of my problem is this, that, you know, I mean, I have a lot of respect for Cotto. I think another great question, though, is, I mean, look, in Cotto's behalf, he just tore apart the guy that was in front of him, and he looked really sharp doing it, and he looked great, good enough to, you know, really, I think, make the fight with Canelo that much more appealing, you know?
Right. It's just occurring to me as you're saying all this that if Golovkin can get the shot now, it actually probably works out better for his legacy, you know, in a hypothetical world in which
than beating Sergio.
If he had gotten the shot at Sergio or a year ago and beaten up a used up, injured Sergio Martinez, we would have still been saying, yeah, he looks great, but I want to see him prove it. I think if he goes in there and beats Cotto, looking the way Cotto is looking now, that means a lot more and makes him the middleweight champion in a more meaningful way. Or even if Cotto loses to Canelo first, Canelo has shown himself to be a guy who's willing to take challenges. The Austin Trout fight was a fight nobody really wanted him to take, even in his own promotional firm. They were kind of advising against it, but he went ahead and took it, and then he fought Mayweather maybe earlier than some people might have advised. He no longer has a zero at the end of his record to protect. I think it's certainly possible that Canelo, if he becomes the middleweight champ, would give Golovkin a shot. And, yeah, as boxing fans, that's kind of what we have to root for and talk up and push for it and try to help the marketplace demand that Golovkin get his shot if he keeps winning.
Yeah, it's kind of unfair that people are just like, well, Golovkin – oh, sorry, man. I just want to say real quick that it's funny that some people are like, Golovkin should just go up to 168 and fight Andre Ward. You know, like, a fighter should have to just move out of the division that he's dominating and fight, like, the guy that people think is the second pound-for-pound fighter in the entire sport. Like, that's what he has to do.
Well, he could.
He need to do. I mean, if anyone should move up, Andre Ward's already beaten every fucking fighter at 168, you know? He's beaten all four guys who have belts there. I mean, come on.
Let's just abolish all the weight classes and just throw them in a blender and everybody fight everybody. Just make it happen, boxing.
Super six from 140 to 668, you just raffle style who fights each other?
Yeah, that's what I say.
With a knife.
And let Teddy Atlas call it so that every 3 seconds he can inform us who's the biggest, stronger man.
He's got to go downtown tomorrow. You know,
hey, what did
played,
you guys
like,
think about that Oscar, that Teddy Atlas Oscar interview the other night? At first I was trying to defend it, like Oscar, maybe he wasn't, you know, under the influence of who the hell knows what, barbiturates or something, but...
I watched it the next morning after already seeing all the Twitter reaction to it, so my expectations were already somewhat shifted because everybody on Twitter was deeming him high and discussing exactly which drugs he was on, so that by the time I watched it, I sat there sort of saying, well, is he necessarily high, or is he just in that first of, like, legitimately giddy to be going into the Hall of Fame and being celebrated all weekend. I think I'd imagine that could create a bit of a natural high. But on top of that, just sort of doing that Oscar thing he's always done where he just finds a way to wrap a big phony smile around everything and seem overexcited about things that aren't that don't seem to command the level of excitement that he is giving them. I don't know. I'm not convinced that he was on anything. I would certainly believe it if he was. I wouldn't doubt that he was, but I don't see hard evidence there that Oscar was floating on some substance.
I didn't really either. I mean, it's kind of tough.
Okay,
to say,
all right.
Like,
so can I backtrack and say that I didn't either?
Well, it was just,
originally
it
I did, and everyone was hammering me like, dude, look at his eyes, and I'm like, I don't see it.
He's weird.
I mean, he's a fucking weirdo. He's talking to Teddy Atlas.
Right.
He's always weird. I don't know. I mean, really though, I think it's a total coincidence that he smelled like smelling salts. I mean, come on.
Right. When he turned and did that line of blow right off of Teddy's knife scar, I mean, that was a total coincidence. I didn't read anything into that.
Well, it just so happens that scar holds exactly an 8-ball. So, come on. I mean, you got to use it.
Right.
Hall of Fame weekend. I would have.
it's so hard to tell because he's so goofy anyway, you know. And plus, it's like his first public appearance since the Golden Boy thing. So I think he was trying so hard to, you know, be happy and look like he had everything under control. And then it's also that he's got Teddy Atlas, like, being kind of, like, his interview style in that interview, did you notice that kind of, like, creepy, like, soft-spoken? It was just kind of, I mean, it was great television, but I couldn't walk away from that, like, definitively saying that, I mean, yeah, based on track record, it didn't look great, but...
It was funny how Teddy the whole time was, you could sense that he was waiting for an opportunity to start asking Oscar some tougher questions that...
more personal.
And so the second that Oscar mentioned Trinidad, Teddy was like, let's talk about that. As long as you brought it up, why did you run away for the last four rounds? You know, it just like jumped on him all of a sudden. It was great.
Yeah, that was pretty funny. Grisham looked like pretty uncomfortable during that whole... Because Grisham was just holding the microphone for Oscar,
right.
I think.
Right.
And then Teddy was like had his own microphone and was interviewing. But
yeah.
No.
Todd's a trooper. We've learned that he's able to navigate through Teddy infested broadcasting waters pretty proficiently, given the high degree of difficulty there.
Yeah, I would imagine that's tough. I mean, you know, Oscar's just a weird dude in general. I don't even know how anybody could tell he's ever on anything. You know, aside from him dressing up in, like, women's clothes and shit. Aside from, I mean, how could you ever tell? He's weird.
Right.
But, you know,
yeah.
If
you told me Oscar was high when the fishnet stockings pictures were taken, I'd certainly believe that.
Yeah, I'd believe you. I don't think you'd need to convince me a whole lot.
Right.
But, you know, to rein it back into what we were talking about with Cotto and Canelo and, like, you know, that kind of taps into, like, this whole Oscar and Golden Boy type of thing. I've heard it repeated since Miguel Cotto doesn't necessarily have any firm ties to any promotional entity. I mean, it seems as though he's kind of trying to branch off on his own and do his own promoting, and he has a strong enough name to be able to kind of pull his own weight in that regard. And we saw some of that in the pre-fight with Sergio Martinez just kind of, you know, whining about, you know, how Cotto negotiated and stuff like that. So what does that mean to you guys as far as, you know, the promotional possibilities of Miguel Cotto's next fight, Mr. Raskin?
Well, it certainly seems that Canelo versus Cotto is a realistically makeable fight, which we would have highly doubted a few weeks ago. I guess it was always makeable in the sense that Cotto is a free agent, sort of, as you say, and when he decided to fight Martinez, he was publicly mulling a fight with Canelo as well. But, yeah, with Schaefer out of the way, with Oscar so openly about wanting to work with Top Rank and mend fences there, it sure seems like it should be pretty straightforward from a promotional point of view. I feel like the networks could be the trickier thing here with, I'm not sure who, if either of them has any long-term contracts, either Cotto with HBO or Canelo with Showtime, but I think at least unofficially there's some brand loyalty there that Cotto, you know, has developed some loyalty to HBO at this point, and Canelo with Showtime. So there are still hurdles to overcome, but it would seem that that is a fight that is eminently makeable compared to all the Cold War fights of the last couple of years that just flat out were not going to happen.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting situation with Cotto in comparison to, you know, other fighters that seem to have a little bit more firm constraints as far as what they can do. But at the very least, to kind of, you know, play devil's advocate on myself as far as the Cotto-Canelo fight goes, you know, regardless of the weight, regardless of the title on the line, I think that most people, you know, most of us in boxing, most fans would agree, fans, writers, whatever, that Miguel Cotto versus Canelo Alvarez is a good fight. That's a fight that stylistically will probably be good, a fight that, you know, in terms of two quality guys facing each other, it's good, regardless of the middleweight stuff. And, you know, I guess there could even be an argument that being able to not have to cut weight might even, I guess, add to it or make them better and less drained, whatever. There could be that argument there, too. So, yeah, at least it opens up some possibilities that are good, and some possibilities that are entertaining and not just total crap fests. However, Canelo still has to get past Lara. I know that I'm sure James Foley over there thinks that he will, but I think that's a tough fight.
What do you think, Foley? Does Lara last 30 seconds with Canelo?
I don't know. I'm favoring Canelo. I don't know. I think Lara's trendy. You know, he's a guy that it sounds cool to say that he's awesome. I mean, he's very good fighter. I think it's going to be a great fight, and no result would really surprise me. I mean, I guess if one of those guys knocked each other out, that would kind of surprise me, but I could see either guy winning. You know, I think Lara's good. I've said before, I mean, I think he's, like, a little overrated, but obviously for boxing, I mean, if Canelo does win that fight, he's basically the number one guy at 154, and, you know, fighting against the middleweight champion, I mean, they can sell that fight on so many different levels. And I think it'll be awesome. So I'm all for that. Even though I'd like to see Golovkin get a shot, but you know, I guess that's probably gonna have to wait.
Yeah, I mean, I think certainly.
Like,
go ahead.
Let me just ask you guys, because I just thought of it. Like, if it's totally 100% up to you, and as much as I've been lobbying for Golovkin, which fight do you guys make? I mean, I think I make Cotto Canelo and just say screw the middleweight thing.
Wait, say the question again. From what perspective are we coming from?
Just from a fan, writer, whatever perspective, okay. From your personal point of view, would you make Cotto Canelo or Cotto Golovkin?
Yeah, if I, as a fan, Cotto Canelo is such a fun fight and such a difficult fight to pick a winner. If I could really control everything, I would do Cotto Canelo with the winner with them both having signed a contract beforehand, agreeing that the winner fights Golovkin next. That would be a scenario I could be happy with.
Yeah,
I think that
I agree.
I can probably
if they wouldn't sign the contract, I'd still do Cotto Canelo.
I think that's a fun fight too. Well, and it kind of depends on the time frame we're looking at. It kind of depends on the time frame, I guess, too, because if we're looking to kind of strike while the iron's hot or whatever and get Miguel Cotto a fight soon, you know, sooner rather than later, Canelo Lara is not happening until next month, and so fighting in September or October might not be in the chips for the winner of that, depending on how that fight goes down, you know, a headbutt, whatever. But, you know, as far as being able to have that play out in a way that I would want it and the fights that I would want, I think that Raskin's scenario probably is the best, yeah.
Well, that's generally correct. Just to agree with Raskin.
True.
And claim that whatever I said is the best, that's always a safe move. I also liked how you, when normally the cliche would have been to say something's not in the cards, you said, Patrick, that it's not in the chips. That was a good subtle poker reference there to get one last plug for the moneymaker effect in. Well done.
That's
on your
right.
Part.
That's right. I was wondering if anyone would catch it.
But, no, I mean, there's no question. Cotto Canelo is just a thoroughly attractive fight on every level, and it just makes so much business sense. I don't think anyone can really complain about it if that comes together. But you're right; he's got to get past Lara first, and that's a month from now. I have heard though, Cotto's team already talking about maybe wanting a December date. So that if that's what they're focused on, then it gives plenty of time for Canelo Lara to happen. And that, but you're right; September is pretty much out of the question. But Mayweather's already tabbed September 13th is his date anyway, so unless Cotto's going to fight him next, September pay-per-view is taken, so we're looking at October, November, December, somewhere in there.
Do you have any suspicion on who you think Mayweather's going to fight next?
I mean, I would be shocked if his people don't try to make some sort of push toward Cotto, put an offer out there, because, I mean, again, that just... To backdoor into history and win the middleweight title by beating a guy he already beat once, it just holds a lot of appeal, assuming Mayweather actually cares about history and lineal championships and things like that. But with that said, the closer we get to it, the more I've gone from lukewarm on it to downright kind of almost dreading it. But I feel like a Maidana rematch is such a likely possibility there. I just don't know who out there is really more marketable than a rematch to a what they'll call the toughest fight of Mayweather's career, even if that's not quite true. It's close enough to true that they're going to call it that and bill it that way. And Maidana has a bigger name now because he shared a pay-per-view headlining bill with Mayweather. I have a feeling that's going to be the one. I mean, I think that probably sells at least as well or better than Danny Garcia or Keith Thurman or any of those other guys who haven't already fought Mayweather.
We can always root for a little Jones Tarver 2 scenario.
That's
first
true.
First fight was tough. Second fight guy just done. No, I don't know.
Yeah,
I'd rather.
I was just going to say, I don't think that's the likely outcome. I think the way the first fight played out led me to believe that by the second half of the fight, Mayweather had worked out all the kinks on how to beat Maidana and would handle him more easily the second time. But sure, one-punch knockout from Maidana would be fun.
Well,
this is
totally like wild speculation, but do you think there will be some other promotional company formed with, you know, Al Heyman's guys, and I mean, who's going to promote that Mayweather fight in September? You know, we're getting close to that, and there's no real other entities that have the experience promoting something on that scale. So how far away are we? Four months?
Right, three months, basically. Are you saying that Mayweather Promotions is not a legit promotional entity that can handle the biggest fights in the world?
I mean,
is that what you're saying? Are you saying that Filthy Rich Records is not an enormous record company, too? I mean, what's going on over there?
Well, you know, everyone always says that line of, like, Mayweather Promotions isn't even licensed in Nevada. So, like, I don't know if it's true, but that's what I've always read, and they've never promoted anything on this scale. I think even most of their Showbox shows have been there's been some kind of co-promoter. But maybe if I'm wrong about that, then at best they've done like Showbox level stuff. I mean, it'll be interesting. But I wouldn't be surprised if that date somehow gets moved back because of all that. I mean, is there an entity ready to go into an endeavor like a major pay-per-view promotion with this little amount of time left, since he basically disavowed, working with Golden Boy? And
Right. I mean, they could. I suppose he could hook up with some other established promoter, like a Goose Tudor or DiBella, or yeah. I mean, there are other
or Glazer.
Why don't we just, frankly, you guys are wasting your time talking to me. If you have a question about the business, you really should be talking to Glazer. Reach out to him on Skype, hook that up. That's your source. Hashtag source.
His wife's black.
With everything, though. That's the best part.
His wife's black, just letting you know. His wife's black, I'm just letting you know.
Okay, is that relevant somehow?
I think he's put that out. Do you follow him on Twitter?
No, I life's too short.
Yeah,
to,
I don't follow him either, but
timeline.
he gets retweeted onto my timeline
right.
a lot. And just
right.
I think more for like comedic purposes, and so I
right.
catch his constant need for, for approval from the black community. It's pretty good stuff.
Okay, I guess I get some of his retweets also, but I hadn't seen any indicating that his wife was black. So that's news to me, but it does. Yeah, no, that now that validates his opinion. Now it's all
totally
different.
He's used it to like defend himself against allegations of him being like racist before.
Right.
It seems like I was going to say it's so funny that like you guys basically you had the opportunity to get in on the ground floor on Glazer when you had that like ill-fated Skype, because Glazer was going to be a guest on Ring Theory podcast.
Right.
And that was before Glazer, that was basically before his kind of ascent to superstardom. I mean, do you regret not taking him, spending another half hour to get him to figure out how to...
I hate to do this, but I really got to point the finger at Detloff on this one. I've always been the one to walk our guests through how to download Skype, but this one time, because it was Bill who was pushing to have Glazer on in the first place, which I think was a good idea. It would have been a fascinating interview. But I said to Bill, I'm like, fine, you want to do it, but you're the one who has to talk to the guy and get him hooked up on Skype. And so, you know, I
think you gave him the Goodfellas, like, you're digging the hole. You're digging
right.
the hole.
That's exactly what it was. And yeah, Bill
yeah,
was unable to dig the hole.
Yeah.
So,
well, that sucks, man. I mean, because he would have told you like the Mayweather Guerrero numbers. I mean, anything you need, anything you wanted to know about the business.
Right.
But too bad.
Yeah. Well, listen, it didn't work out that time. It doesn't mean we'll never have him on Ring Theory.
Well, you know, Eric, James had said that you were going to need to cruise out a little less than an hour into the show. So whenever you need
right.
to go, let us know.
Yeah, I got about 5 more minutes if you guys
cool.
had other essential topics that you want me for. And then, again, we, you know, just patch it right over to Glazer. Glazer, if you're listening, the call-in number is right there. You can take over for me as soon as I have to go.
We're waiting for you,
that
buddy.
That would be funny.
And
well,
actually,
he tweeted his cell phone a bunch of times. I've always thought it'd be funny to like contract a conference call him, and then I just thought, no, that probably wouldn't actually be very fun, you know?
Right.
Well, I want his eyeglasses consultant's number. Really, that's what I'm going for. But I mean, you know, I just kind of lean that way.
Nice frames.
That's what I want to know. I want some advice here.
Right. No, I mean, he understands how the glasses business works in a way that you couldn't possibly ever understand.
Well, he also had that, you know. He's Western New York's link to big time boxing for 2 decades.
There you go. Is that what it says on his business card?
It's on his Twitter handle.
Yeah,
does it also say married to a black woman on his business card? Do you think?
No, the business card itself is black. Got white writing.
Right. Right. There you go. I got to say, actually, Patrick, as long as we're on this subject, it does seem that you mentioned that your wife is Mexican quite a lot on this show. Are you playing some kind of angle to give yourself legitimacy that you speak to the Hispanic boxing fans because of that?
Oh, Jesus. I just got called out in a big way.
Yeah.
I would have to say that that's pretty accurate, really. I've you know, it's no secret, Mr. Raskin. I've wanted to be Mexican my whole life, and just didn't work out that way.
Right.
Yeah.
So you married into it.
That's the next
best thing you
yeah.
can do.
You know, learn a little bit of Spanish, drink a couple Mexican beers, and I'm there, right? I'm pretty close.
Right.
Oh, man. Great.
Did
Thanks.
You see this breaking,
Good
this
job
breaking
having
news here?
On
that
there,
yeah, he just basically destroyed you. and your wife's probably not even Mexican.
I don't even know if he has a wife.
Oh.
Yeah, exactly. We don't
I'm questioning everything.
We could be talking to Rick Glazer right now. I mean, we really don't know anything about.
Yeah, I mean, if Rick Glazer wore a big fake beard, what would he look like, Patrick?
Now I know. Now I know because I texted him in Spanish, and that's why he didn't get back to me. Shit. Should have texted him in box.
All right,
well,
yeah,
Eric,
No, I got 1 minute.
Well,
go ahead.
All right, well, I wanted to ask you, man, just like of your years at ringside, you know, we always hear the Ray feel like, oh, I was at Corrales Castillo. What is your like top memory from like just going nuts at a fight? I mean, on the inside, obviously you kept your professionalism, but were there times when it was a strain to do that?
Yeah, there have certainly been a few of those times. I mean, this is always the fight I'm going to cite when people ask me for my most memorable ringside moment, but Gaddy Ward won. I mean, I was, you know, so fortunate to be at all of those Gaddy Ward fights, actually, but the first one, the ninth round, you know, there's just nothing else I've seen that compares, and the story that I've told a few times that I was actually sitting next to Lou DiBella and didn't realize at the time that he was Mickey Ward's advisor. I think that was like a relationship they just started off. So I didn't really realize he was rooting strongly for one guy, but he just started going absolutely apeshit in that ninth round and was shoving his elbow into my rib cage over and over again, like probably unconsciously, not even realizing he was doing it. And eventually, when he thought the fight was being stopped late in the round, he actually like ran away from his seat and like rushed toward the ring. And everyone at ringside was just unconsciously standing up. Not you just were so caught up in that moment. That's the one that stands out as just this insane level of excitement that I don't think any other sport could really recreate.
That's unforgettable stuff.
Yeah.
Rasmus,
but
my
rib cage is recovered, thankfully.
And you, by the way, that was first of all epic telling of that story, and second of all, you almost verged on a Lampley there, like about midway through.
Did I start getting choked up?
I heard. It sounded like there was just maybe like a lump in the throat. So.
Right. Well, if I had started to cry on TQBR radio, then in the words of Frank Cappuccino, that is a no-no. So I'm glad I didn't do it, because that would have been a no-no.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Yeah, and, thank you, guys. It's always fun talking to you.
Hey, what's the name of that site where if people wanted to check out the Moneymaker Effect, what's the best? Just Google it.
So two options. Either go to Amazon.com and type in either my name or Moneymaker Effect, or the publisher's website is ShopLVA, as stands for Las Vegas Advisor, ShopLVA.com. So those are the two options. You can get it paperback or the Kindle or iTunes download, the digital version, whichever you prefer.
All right, awesome.
Ah, well, that makes it easy for me then. I think I'm gonna go ahead and grab the Kindle version of that then, because now I'm interested.
You do it up. Me.
Well, thanks again for coming on. We really appreciate it, and we'll have you on again in the future if that's cool.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure, guys.
All right. Thanks a lot, and take it easy.
All right. Take it easy.
You too. Bye.
All right. Bye. All right. Oh, Mr. Raskin, always a good guest. Well, I guess
yeah,
I couldn't say always, because
he's
only been on once before.
What was funny, though, is like when he started giving his answer about Gotti Ward, he used almost the exact same phrasing as Lampley, too. Which I was about ready to like interrupt, but it was like literally, remember that from the Legendary Knights?
Yes.
Where he was just like, you know, whenever I'm asked my greatest fight, I say Gotti Ward, round 9.
Yeah.
You need to give a screenshot of Raskin crying to accompany the famous Lampley picture that Bag was doing.
Well, maybe next time we'll do like Scott Crist and Connor Rubus are doing, and do like a Skype video so we can get Raskin crying.
Yeah, that would be I don't know about that, man.
No, maybe not. All right.
But anyway.
Well,
it might be worthy for a special anniversary episode or something.
Yeah, we could totally. Yeah, like our like.
We're
65th show or something.
Yeah.
Well, I guess carrying on with the boxing business, did you catch the whole rest of that Martinez or Cotto Martinez card?
Yeah. I thought it was pretty good, man. I mean, considering that we thought it was basically crap on paper, but actually, I kind of looked at it that day, and it seemed it was kind of like, oh, these could actually be pretty decent fights, and a couple of them were.
Yeah, I mean, I begrudgingly gave it credit. You know, afterwards, we always talk shit, but, you know, we talked a lot of shit about, you know, probably wasn't going to be, pretty much everybody was, really. It wasn't just us. But, you know, I will say, apart from can't even think about it right now, what freaking fight it was, Marvin Sonsona versus Wilfredo Vasquez Jr. That fight sucked. I wasn't really into that fight at all. But apart from that, it was pretty decent. It was pretty good. So, you know, I was pretty, whatever. That was pretty crappy.
No,
but,
I mean,
well,
I'm with you.
Well, how about freaking Andy Lee pulling that knockout
awesome.
Out of his ass?
Pretty awesome, yeah. And Jackson looked good prior to that point. It's kind of almost too bad for him, you know. I don't want to see you lose like that, champ. You know, do a little Arthur McCanty. But
I mean, the thing about Andy Lee is like, yeah, it was awesome, but you know, and I'm down with Andy Lee as a certain level of fighter. I mean, look, for pay per view opener, I actually think that was a pretty good fight. Dude, awesome the way that it ended, you know. But I don't think Andy Lee's going to be like a top contender or anything like that. But yeah, he can make a lot of fun fights with guys, and I think that. Man, it was the knockout was just spectacular. I mean, that's maybe probably my knockout of the year. I think I'd escalate that even above the Carl Froch, George Groves. You know, I mean, as a pure knockout, the punch was better, undeniably. It's just kind of a matter of does the magnitude of that event kind of offset, you know, the fact that this was like a pay-per-view opener and that's in front of 80,000 people in the main event. Maybe, I don't know, that's, you got to weigh that into it. But I think that, man, just... I mean, it was really a sickening knockout. I mean, he was just out. I saw his eyes roll back to his head on the way, you know, his way in midair.
Yeah, that was pretty rough. I mean, and like you said, that's pretty much what it comes down to is, do you favor the relevance of Carl Froch's knockout over George Groves, or do you favor a serious, like, you know, second-to-second shift in momentum type of deal? I mean... We just don't really see stuff like that all that often. That's kind of like one of those like once a year type of things. Like, for example, something I'm reminded of would be Robbie Peden versus Nate Campbell 1, where Nate Campbell like sticks his chin out like, you know, go ahead and hit me, and Robbie Peden sticks his head down and then gives him an uppercut and knocks him out. Or something like Lucien Boutte versus who was it? Santarita, what's his name? Oh, man. The dude who fought Arthur Abraham and broke his jaw. Help me out here. Middleweight.
Andrade?
No, Kelly Pavlik fought him, too. Shit. I don't know why I'm...
Wait, Edison Miranda?
Yes, Edison Miranda. I don't know why I was drawing a blank on his name. But, yeah, and like, you know, Edison Miranda gets hit by, like, a jab or something like that, and then he sticks his pelvis out, like, go ahead and hit me, and then gets knocked out with a body shot or some shit. You know, things like that that are just kind of like, you just don't see him very often. And that was pretty much what had happened. Seconds into the fight, Andy Lee got knocked down and hurt, and I was like, great, dude, here we go. You know, me talking up Andy Lee, nice guy, good interview, nice kid, good story, blah, 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 and then he's going to go on and get his ass kicked. But then, you know, he wasn't really winning the fight, and then he just pulled the knockout straight out of his ass.
Yeah, it was crazy, man. I mean, it was just, like, totally out of nowhere. I mean, he lost, like, every second of that fight. You know, and lost it. I mean, he was, like, pretty – I mean, I don't know if he was, like, badly hurt, but the knockdown, I mean, it wasn't, like, a flash knockdown. I mean, he took a pretty big punch. And and even right before the knockout, I mean, it looked like, man, he had him – you know, Jackson had him on the ropes. It was, like – and I was thinking Jackson was kind of an intriguing, like, prospect. His only loss before that was to Willie Nelson, the boxer.
Yeah, that was rough, man.
Nelson's pretty good. You know, so I just thought that, like, you know, Jackson maybe. I mean, I guess in these situations, I'm always kind of rooting for the guy who has a big in my, you know, might have a bigger upside. But I think, yeah, fuck. I mean, Andy Lee. You know, you can't really rule that to luck. I mean, it was a perfect punch, and it's a guy who knows how to throw it.
Yeah, and yeah. I mean,
great timing.
I apologize for using a mixed martial arts reference here. Well, first of all, one of the guys who listens to the show and follows along and stuff like that and follows, I don't know if he follows you on Twitter, but regardless, his name is Clemming with a one as the I. Point is, he said he thought it looked like Castro versus Jackson, and that's a pretty good reference, although what it really reminded me of, and people should honestly check it out because it's pretty gnarly looking, is they should check out Scott Smith versus, I think it was Pete Sell. It's on YouTube. I'm positive it's on YouTube, and it's a UFC fight. But it was almost like an exact replay of what we saw happen. Slightly different, but Scott Smith wound up getting hit to the body, and he was like crumbled, like, you know, about to go down and get knocked out badly. And then Pete Sell runs at him to finish him, and then, like, midair as he's, like, jumping to punch him or something like that, gets knocked out. It's, like, you know, anyway. Point is, just name-dropping, and you should check it out. It was pretty solid stuff. And, I mean, as far as moving forward with what Andy Lee could or should be doing in the division or whatever the case may be, I think that we're probably on the same page in that Andy Lee is a nice kid, fun guy to watch a lot of the time, but probably won't be going super far. What's your opinion?
I'm the same boat, but, you know, I mean, he could be some fights that'll be fun to watch. And what about Andy Lee and Matthew Macklin? I mean, that, you know, I'd favor Macklin, but is Lee trying to fight at junior middleweight now, though, or something?
Yeah. He had moved down a little bit, and so I don't know exactly what their plans are as far as weight, but I mean, you know, yeah.
He's going to be in some fun shit. I mean, he's probably never going to be, you know, competing against the best guys in the division, but why not, like, just for starters, something like James Kirkland, Andy Lee, you know? I mean, I think that's a level he could hang with, and he's got a little bit of a name and a fun style, obviously got some power, you know, and... But, I mean, really, his only loss since that first Brian Vera fight, he lost to Chavez, who was, you know, such a huge middleweight. And that, I mean...
Yeah. Well, I probably wouldn't...
I
probably wouldn't be in a big hurry to put him in with somebody that's a big puncher. You know, if I were his advisor, manager, matchmaker, whatever, I probably wouldn't be in a big rush to put him in with anybody that's... you know, a real big puncher, super tough, has a really good chin or anything like, well, okay, I'd pretty much just put him in with a small child. Let's put it that way.
I wouldn't put him with anyone good.
But no, he can be, you know, he can be a fairly fun guy, you know, in some good fights and stuff like that. But how about John Jackson? You know, I actually thought, okay, it's obviously kind of sounds stupid to say, before he got knocked out brutally, he looked good. But he did. Before he got knocked out brutally, he looked pretty good.
I know. That's what I'm saying. I was kind of like it, you know.
Trying to jump
on that train for a bit, and then it got totally derailed.
Yeah, it got absolutely
derailed. Because I agree with you, man. After the first few rounds, I mean, he was controlling that fight. And, you know, Andy Lee's not going to be on the pound-for-pound list, but he's not a total scrub. I mean, you have to be pretty good to beat him, and Jackson was doing that. But, you know, hey, I mean, it didn't end well for him, and those are the kind of knockouts that you really wonder if the guy's ever going to be the same, or if now he's just going to have, like, a glass chin for the rest of, you know.
Yeah, Andy Lee is one of the dudes that's really easy to like and stuff like that, and so it's nice to see him going forward. But, yeah, I mean, he did basically get dominated for much of the fight against, of course, Julian Jackson's son. So I think that tie to Julian Jackson, especially for people who, you know, dig older fights and, you know, like to watch that type of stuff, it was kind of cool. But, yeah, I mean, I think that with a couple tweaks and here and there, I think that he could probably come back to a pretty decent form. But anyway, it was a pretty monster knockout.
It looked that way. Yeah, it looked like, I mean, I guess he came to pretty quickly, but he was out. That's not good.
Yeah, he was sleeping.
And I don't really buy that he has the same kind of power that his dad had. You know what I mean? I thought that was maybe a little bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah,
he put
me down, but he didn't really hurt him. And, you know, because it's one thing, like, if you've got that kind of power, then, yeah, okay, you'll get knocked out a few times, but you're going to be able to beat elite opponents. And this kid, it's just too early to say that, if he'll be able to come back or not. You know, I mean... It sucks for him because it's a pretty bad loss to take, you know?
Yeah, they were reaching, looking for that connection, you know?
Well, Lampley was like, he has the same power as his father.
Yeah, they were reaching pretty hard looking for that connection, and it's not there. He doesn't have that, yeah, well, needless to say, you don't need to tell
anybody.
One
of the greatest knockout punchers of the modern era, you know?
Yeah, like guys who was just a dude who was just giving guys naps left and right. You know, it's not on the same level. Regardless, yeah, I'd like to see him again. Let's see, before we get on with the preview
of this
weekend.
He wants to get back to it. And, yeah.
What's that?
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say that before we get to the previewing of this coming weekend.
Something that I thought was fairly relevant was that Daniel Ponce de Leon was TKO'd this past weekend in 9 rounds and then announced his retirement after the fight. And so I thought that was relevant just because he was a pretty fun dude to watch. I don't know if his retirement's going to stick, because how often do fighters retire and it actually sticks? But for his sake, I hope it does, because he was a fun dude to watch.
Oh, man.
Seemed like a pretty nice guy, and you know, he had a pretty respectable career. A lot of us thought he beat Adrian Broner on the way to Broner losing to Maidana. You know, a lot of us kind of pegged him as exposing Adrian Broner in that fight. And on top of that, he's been a pretty clubbing puncher, a big puncher. He's had some really memorable knockouts. So, yeah, it sucks to see a dude like that out of the game.
Yeah, it's so crazy, man. You go from being a big favorite in the Lopez rematch, you know, and kind of having his way with him the first couple rounds, and then, man, that, you know, crazy knockout, Wanma suddenly revives his career, you know, or he was basically on life support, and now De Leon is done.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Man, he's a dude that's, I don't really see how anybody could not like Daniel Ponce de Leon, because you know exactly what you're going to get. Going into every fight, he's either basically going to get knocked out or knock the other dude out for the most part. So, you know, he was pretty much must-watch TV as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, to just to kind of see
born,
him.
Born on, he was born on the side of a mountain.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
I mean, the guy's just a
badass.
He's a badass. Yeah, serious badass. So, yeah, it's a loss, needless to say. It's a bummer that he's going to be dropping out. But perhaps, you know, considering his style, a good decision, because he doesn't really need to stick around and get his ass kicked anymore. So, yeah, it's bittersweet. But anyway, I had listed him on an article I wrote about 2 years ago. I had written an article about, like, the top 12 best punchers of the last 12 years. Why? I don't know. Just because I did and whatever. Anyway, if you go on to Queensberry Rules, you can check it out. There's video and stuff like that. But one of the gnarliest knockouts that I can remember, period, actually was with Daniel Ponce de Leon. And I actually have to look up this dude's name because it was kind of crazy here. He went by a different name before. It's Saad Kokia Jim now, but he used to go by Saad Luk Nong Tang Yang Toy. Yeah, it's a mouthful, but if you check it out on YouTube, it's one of the gnarliest knockouts you'll see. Yeah, no, I'm not spelling it at all. Just go look up Daniel Ponce de Leon's record. Anyway. Moving on to this coming weekend, it's going to be Ruslan Provodnikov versus Chris Algieri on HBO. Past it being Ruslan Provodnikov, I'm not even really sure where to go on this one. I haven't really even taken it upon myself to look up a whole lot of Chris Algieri stuff. Do you know much about this?
Yeah, I mean, I've basically spent the last, like, 18 hours in this soundproof room watching all of Chris Algieri's both kickboxing matches and boxing, professional boxing match.
Oh, good. Good.
And I'm picking Ruslan to win by TKO in the fifth round.
Well, as long as you have an educated decision here, then, yeah.
No, the truth of it is, I don't know much about him. I've seen him on ESPN a time or two somewhere. I've heard the name, and it hasn't really registered. And, you know, I've looked him up and read a little bit about him going into this fight, and I guess I just don't have any reason to really think he's going to be able to hang with Provodnikov. I think Provodnikov has shown that he's pretty special, you know, and I think he's probably, you know, you just look at the level of competition and some of the guys that, you know, Algeria's gone the distance with, I think that Provodnikov's going to batter him around the ring. We'll see. I mean, a lot of these guys have stepped up to a level and performed better, you know, better than expectations. And I didn't think Herrera would be able to trouble Danny Garcia, and that really surprised me. And I don't think Provodnikov is necessarily unbeatable, but I just think he's been in with such better competition, and I think he's going to punish this guy.
Would it be fair to say that you think that Ruslan Provodnikov's mom versus Chris Algieri's mom would probably be more competitive.
I doubt it. You know, I'd have to look at Mrs. Algieri, but I would make her a pretty prohibitive, you know, underdog.
Yeah, pretty strong underdog, needless to say, because Mrs. Provodnikov is a bit of a beast, in a good way.
Yeah, well, yes. I think I saw this fight with maybe Chris Algieri and Mike Arnutis, and I just remember him getting destroyed by Victor Ortiz, and I don't know. You know, years later, I mean, if a guy's going the distance, I know Algieri outboxed him and won by a wide margin, but I still think that if he doesn't have that kind of power to be able to get, you know, get rid of Arnutis, he's not going to get rid of Ruslan, you know?
Yeah.
Come on. And if you don't get rid of Ruslan, you're either going to get the living shit kicked out of you for 12 rounds, or you're going to get stopped. And hey, by the way, dude, just to run it back for a second, that was pretty awesome, that Pablo Sarmiento in the corner to Sergio before the stoppage. Come on, dude. I know there was a tear, like, just trick. When Sarmiento stopped the fight against Martinez and Cotto.
His last, the last little exchange.
Yeah,
where
he was like, you are my champion, Sergio. Yeah, yeah.
You're always going to be my champion. Yeah, that was a little rough. Yeah,
well,
it was a little rough. What, are you expecting, like, something? Are you expecting something similar from from Algieri's corner?
Well, I was just thinking of stoppages, I do think that it's at some point. I mean, I just Provodnikov's the real deal, man. I really think so. I think that the Bradley fight was not a fluke. It might have been, you know, a not the best version of Bradley. He probably did have some problems going into that fight, but regardless, I mean, I think Provodnikov's gotten even better. He looked even better against Alvarado, and I can't wait to watch. You know, he's one of those guys, I'll watch him pretty much against whoever. You know, he's just a compelling figure. I mean, that 2 days thing that they did on Provodnikov was better than any 24/7 or all access or any of that bullshit in the last years. Maybe since Cesar Chavez Jr. was floating in his swimming pool, you know.
That was pretty tough to beat. Yeah.
that's all time. But
if we do see a stoppage, like, you know, if we do see a kind of Sarmiento-Martinez moment for Algieri, it's going to be Chris Algieri's trainer going, Chris, you're always going to be my NABF Junior Intercontinental America's champion, buddy. Always. You're always going to be my youth WBC Federation WBF champion, man.
No, man. I mean, that is true. The word champion gets used a lot. Well, you know what's funny is I had people over for the fight, and, you know, Martinez is a champion, basically. I mean, well, he is. I mean, he beat Kelly Pavlik. Although, if you really want to be a nitpicker or whatever, you could be like, well, Pavlik had already, you know, moved up to 170 and lost. I mean, I don't like that. It's the same reason why I don't like, you know, Chad Dawson with the light heavyweight thing. I don't like that, like, you moved up, lost, came back down. But regardless, look, Martinez was the middleweight champion. There's no denying it. What was funny, though, is, like, right after that fight, I had people over, and one of my buddies had never seen Bradley Provodnikov and wanted to watch it, so we're watching some of that. And there's this line from Max Kellerman where he says, like, Timothy Bradley is the definition of champion. And, look, I agree. But he's actually not ever really been a champion in boxing. He just hasn't. I mean, if you want to go one weight, you know, one champion per division. Now, he was pretty close at 140, and maybe you can even make the argument that him against Alexander was suitable enough, you know, to make him the champion at 140, although he wasn't recognized as that because of Amir Khan was always, like, the number two guy there. But you know, Bradley really wasn't a champ. Isn't a champion as a boxer, in boxing. He's just not. He wasn't the real welterweight champion. He wasn't the real junior welterweight champion. You know, and it's just funny because, like, I get what Kellerman was saying, and I agree with it. Bradley embodies all of those terms that you associate with it. But it's just another example of, like, it's used way too much in this sport because we have so many that basically, like you said, everybody's a champion. And then it just has no meaning to it, you know. So I thought when Pablo Sarmiento said that, I mean, he really was talking to the champion,
at middleweight. And, you know, it was kind of a sad end to the era, but at the same time, I mean, to do it in front of, like, that kind of awesome crowd and to give the Cotto and his fans, like, that kind of, you know, career highlight, it was, I mean, I think it could have been a lot worse, you know?
No, it definitely could have been worse. Oh, man. Well, yeah, in the wake of, like, since you kind of brought it up, in the wake of this whole, in the Cotto, you know, beating Martinez thing, somebody who's kind of following along right now on Twitter, Matthew Mojica, who is the fight source, is his name, he had asked if we could discuss real quickly the, I think it was yesterday or the day before, and I think it was Greisman who had posted a video where Freddie Roach had said that he had never seen Golovkin before. And so, you know, presumably because I think it was in context, it was because, you know, they were saying, well, Cotto's the middleweight champion now, so what's up with Golovkin? And Freddie Roach's response was, I've never seen Golovkin before, except for, you know, not too long ago, a video had surfaced of Golovkin sparring Julio Cesar Chavez Jr. and basically giving him the business. And Freddie Roach was the one who was standing on the ring apron at that moment. So, you know, it's really? Either, anyway, the point
seen,
is,
I don't
either,
know who that is.
Yeah, either he's legitimately, like, not remembering here because maybe he's just doesn't follow boxing, or maybe he just didn't know who it was that his fighter was sparring or something. So maybe it's possible that he just doesn't know, or maybe he's just being, you know, Freddie Roach and being perhaps a little more manipulative than, you know, people think he is, and being a little smarter than people think he is and stuff like that. I don't know. Do you have any opinion on that?
I don't really know. I mean, I probably, you know, I mean, I would imagine, but, you know, I think Roach is a pretty busy guy, and it you know, like when Mayweather always talks about how he never sees these fights, I don't believe that for a second. You know, I think Floyd watches a shitload of boxing, but Roach is somebody that I believe, like, may not actually tune into it, like, every weekend without his fighters fighting. So as far as, like, that he hasn't seen Golovkin fight, I mean, it's pretty doubtful. But I don't know. I mean, I didn't see the video of Golovkin sparring Chavez. I didn't really know about any of that. Roach is becoming, like, more. Well, he's, like, becoming less and less, like, credible. I mean, he seems to say a lot of things that shouldn't really be taken as, you know.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, taken with a grain of salt.
Yeah, no, I do. I remember a handful of years ago, I got the chance to interview Freddie, like, two or three times, like, kind of briefly on video. So he and I are best friends. I'm just dropping that right there. But, you know, he was always a nice dude. He was always, every time I asked him if I could interview him, you know, like, it was just kind of off the cuff, on the spot. Can I interview you? Yeah, sure. Real nice guy. So, you know, at least my personal experience with him was good. But, you know, I've had far more experience reading about him and, you know, watching him and listening to him and stuff like that than, you know, any personal experience. And he just comes off like he's just like he's trying to be a manipulative advisor rather than just a trainer, you know, just kind of injecting himself into stories where he doesn't really belong. But that's just kind of how
I
see it. And, you know, this doesn't
I don't
really
know why he's been talking
anything.
So much the last couple fights. You know, it seems like he's just been talking like way more shit than he has before. I mean, I guess, you know, he did a while ago. If you think back on it, there were a couple fights where he was saying something like, going into Pacquiao De La Hoya, I mean, he certainly wasn't shy. I mean, they kind of centered the 24/7 series, you know, a lot around him then too. But just recently, it seems like he's kind of like escalated the shit talking to another level. You know, especially like with this Cotto Martinez, and then trying to remember, maybe it was Pacquiao and Rios, or even the Pacquiao Bradley. It's a strange persona for him to adopt, you know, because he's a really likable guy in some ways and kind of been a compelling, interesting character in the sport. But, I mean, I kind of agree with you, you know, the recent. And I don't know if you – did you notice, like, after the fight, it looked like Martinez and Roach were kind of having some friction when he was kind of going around the ring. And it seemed like it looked like Roach was almost, like, apologizing to him, basically saying that he didn't mean what he said before the fight.
I wasn't
but
sure
for,
what was going on. That was in
yeah,
general.
Yeah, you know what I'm talking
I mean,
about, though, right?
Well, yeah, and I do, and I'll be honest here. I watched a stream. I didn't buy that shit. I didn't want to buy that shit because I thought that the card was going to be really bad. And, of course, now I kind of actually feel bad having watched a stream because it was a decent card and I would have paid for it regardless.
Don't say that, man. Glazer will get the FBI on you.
I know, dude. I'm going to get fucking, you know, raided any minute. But, you know, so, but I did see it. And I did, and so I'm not entirely sure if the feed that I saw was the same because I was watching the, I think it was like a Sky Sports feed or something like that, or a Box Nation or something. And anyway, point is, after the fight, just the entire scene was kind of bizarre, you know, because then, okay, the stoppage happened, and it was clear that that was it, you know, and I think just about everybody could understand because Martinez was getting shit-kicked. The last two or three rounds, he was taking an ass-kicking, and I was sitting there going like, all right, you know, at some point they're going to think about stopping this because Martinez can't do anything. And then, you know, after the fight, like after it was clear it was stopped, you know, Cotto celebrated, and then he started walking around the ring. And when he had initially spoken to Martinez, Martinez obviously was, you know, probably not in a good mood and stuff like that. But then when Roach came around, it just kind of looked like the dynamic changed a little bit, like they like almost were going to jaw at each other or something. It was just weird. The entire thing was just really bizarre. You know, I was still kind of trying to understand
what
exactly just happened.
From what I saw, it looked like, yeah, it looked like Roach was trying to, like, give him, like, the, you know, the end of the fight, like, congratulations or whatever, and Sergio, like, said something back to him, probably because of what Roach had been saying, like, leading into the fight. And then I think Roach was kind of trying to, like, basically, like, apologize. But it looked like they made up by the end of the exchange that I saw. But for a second there, yeah, it did look like a little tense. And I thought Cotto and Martinez both showed pretty good sportsmanship.
Yeah, it wasn't, yeah, you know, it wasn't embarrassing. It wasn't a Broner Malignaggi moment.
It wasn't.
For
wasn't
sure.
It wasn't. Yeah. Or any of like Riddick Bowe's fights.
Yeah. No shit.
Broke out every single.
Oh, horrible. Well, as far as Ruslan Provodnikov goes, and I guess that kind of applies here since we're talking about Freddie Roach. But as far as Ruslan Provodnikov goes, you know, it sounds basically like we're expecting him to go right through Chris Algieri, and I think that's probably a realistic expect. That said, who's on the menu?
After this fight?
Yeah.
I think the big one is potentially Pacquiao. I'd kind of like to maybe – I'm not really like in a huge hurry to get that fight, even though I think it would be a pretty awesome, because I just think Provodnikov – you know, if I think a lot of it might depend on how the Golden Boy top rank thing kind of shakes out, you know. But I mean, you could see some perfect fights with Provodnikov against like Lucas Matisse or Danny Garcia, and I think he's kind of earned that spot to be a top contender at junior welterweight, and he deserved those fights. But I guess the Pacquiao fight's probably the big one top rank would try to do, but I'm kind of hoping and thinking that, you know, personally, I do want to see the fifth installment of the Marquez fight and then take it from there. But, I mean, yeah, I think Provodnikov's right in that mix. A Bradley rematch would be awesome, and Bradley might be looking for something to kind of get, you know, the crazy fucker that he is. He probably does want to get back in there and try to get his, you know. I mean, I wouldn't want to get back with Provodnikov if I was him, but, you know, so he's going to have options, man. He's getting more and more popular. He's getting exposure. I mean, I know a lot of guys who are casual fans and maybe know, like, you know, 10 fighters in the world, and they know him because they saw the show on HBO. And I think he'll be, you know, he's going to get a big fight. It's just there's some pieces that are going to shuffle. You know, it all depends on Pacquiao and Marquez. And if some of the Golden Boy side opens up at 140 or 147, I mean, you could have a field day just thinking about all the fights you can make. You know, I mean, for Provodnikov against Keith Thurman, love to see that.
It's a bummer that, you know, that he's just not more in demand. I mean, it's obvious why he's not more in demand, because he's a dangerous guy. He's super tough. He's going to be in there to absorb punishment, and he can punch, and he's, you know, just kind of a badass. So it sucks to know that there are so many shifts and things going on from 140 to 147 pounds there.
and that he's kind of on the outside looking in, because he probably deserves to be a little bit more in the mix.
Well, you know, man, I think he's getting big. I mean, like, outside of obviously, like, Pacquiao, Marquez, and probably, like, you know, Bradley, Danny Garcia, but other than that, I think Provodnikov is probably a bigger name than any of the other guys. You could, you know, like Keith Thurman or Sean Porter or Danny, you know, or Lucas Matisse, any of the guys. I think he's got probably among mainstream, he's got as big of a name as Maidana did going into you know, the Floyd fight. I mean, he's probably not as accomplished on paper, but then again, I mean, he did go, you know, pretty much went to war and arguably could have won against a real top welterweight in Tim Bradley. And now he came back and just looked like a, you know, beast at 140 against Alvarado. So I've been surprised that more people than I would imagine. You know, a lot of times, I mean, I have a lot of friends who are just casual fans, and I'll have to remind them of fighters. You know, I have to, like, but I think Provodnikov has stuck because he's been, you know, he's so intense. And, you know, of course, his mom being such a memorable character, that's a connection that a lot of people have made. And I think he's going to be one of those guys who it's going to be easy for him to get more and more popular as he gets a higher profile, because he's just such a unique type of person.
Well, you know, word on the street is that Ruslan Provodnikov has trained for this fight in a 12th century Constantinople butcher shop. Is that true, James Foley?
I know he's like... Basically, like, those guys I mentioned don't even deserve to have their names linked to Provodnikov, even as his, like, knockout victims. I mean, they are so far beneath his level of manhood that...
Yeah.
But yeah,
no,
I love
the
guy, and most boxing fans love him too. And he's gonna, you know, just what can you say about him, man? I mean, like, there's nothing polarizing whatsoever, I don't think, about Ruslan Provodnikov, man. Everyone I know who's seen the guy has just immediately fallen in love with him. And the more you see, you know, pause, by the way, but you see the face-off with Alvarado was awesome. The 2 days thing was awesome. The more and more we get to know of his personality too. I mean, he's just a compelling ass motherfucker. And he's going to be, you know, I can't wait for him to, if he can perform well and do, which, you know, we saw the Bradley fight. There's no reason, I mean, if he can perform well in a big fight and get more exposure, I think he really could become, you know, a superstar. The question with him is he a good enough fighter to do it? Will he be able to win the big fight next time? You know, whereas a guy like Golovkin, I think, has a lot of star quality, and I think he's a good enough fighter, but the question is kind of like, will he have the opponents to propel him? But, you know, I think the next boxing star is coming out of the Eastern Bloc.
Well, man, he's a friggin' beast. He is, and he is a compelling figure, too, for sure. There's no question. And on top of that, I heard that he was watching that Cotto moment where he was jump roping on the 24/7 thing, and he saw his, you know, he saw that, and he was like, oh, poor little boy. That's just what I heard, you know, because I heard that he's a bit of a beast in that regard, too. Pause.
He's known for that. You know, he really was probably naturally more of a lightweight. But
he jumped a few weight classes there.
Yeah.
Let's see.
He's got some extra pack and the extra packaging.
We've gone there. Yeah, this show has devolved for sure. What's the on the undercard?
The first
there?
Open speculation
it was
on the size of Ruslan's penis. I'm proud of this.
Yep, we're groundbreaking in that regard. Gosh, what's the fight
on
the?
We don't know that,
but
we can go ahead. the Demetrius Andrade.
It's Demetrius Andrade versus I just know his last
Brian
name.
Brian
Rose. There you go. Do we that? I kind of even like Demetrius Andrade more than the average person, and I just don't really give a shit. Like, does anybody care? I don't know.
No, I mean, I'm kind of same boat with you, thinking that Andrade will basically just easily outbox him. Kind of want to see Andrade fight somebody a little bit higher profile and more skilled. I do like him. You know, I think he's got a lot of, you know, I mean, he has some tools that you can obviously see. He's got quick hands. He's a good boxer. Kind of alarming. Who dropped him in the first round? Was that Marta Rosian? That's kind of brutal. But he did come back and outbox
I think so, yeah.
Pretty easily.
After that,
I think he's
pretty
good. It's a weird card for HBO. I mean, it's another one of these kind of like. I mean, yeah, we're all just down because Ruslan's the man. But as a whole, I mean, it's not really that good of a card.
Yeah, not kinda really.
Kind of like that Sergey Kovalev card with Agnew.
Exactly. You know? That's actually exactly what I was going to say, was that it kind of reminded me of, it reminded me of a guy that's kind of like from the, you know, quote-unquote Eastern Bloc that's viewed as a beast and can punch and is tough and blah, 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 against somebody that we don't know a whole lot about and is liable to just kind of, you know, dominate and maybe make it look somewhat fun while dominating him, but that's about the extent of it. Because that's exactly what it looks like.
Yeah. I mean, Algieri's probably a little bit higher profile than Agnew is, and Kovalev maybe is more dominant in his division than Provodnikov is. But yeah, it's definitely not an upgrade from, you know, Mike Alvarado and Tim Bradley. I mean, it's definitely kind of a breather type of fight.
Yeah,
and that's fine.
Sure.
I mean, look, man, dude, in the state of boxing today, I'm happy to pay for HBO to watch Provodnikov fight against, you know, a guy who's going to be a pretty big underdog. I mean, because that's just how it is. I want to see his fight, so fuck. I mean, well, we have to take it, I guess. But yeah, it'll be nice if next time. I don't know what they do. I haven't thought about it, but I guess everything, you know, it starts with Marquez and Pacquiao, and then because, you know, Bradley's going to be a piece of this puzzle, and if they figure out what's going on with the golden boy, Al Haymon, who's left there, and one side of that group is going to work with the Top Rank, then that, you know, that opens some stuff up. But you know, I don't see any reason. I mean, of all these fights that you could make with just the Top Rank guys, I mean, I still think Provodnikov and Bradley rematch would be great.
I don't see why anybody would be turning that down.
Yeah, I mean, first fight was fight of the year.
I definitely wouldn't. Well, to not totally
but I haven't
switch
heard anyone
gears
talk about
because,
it.
Well, to not totally switch gears because it's still HBO, but since you brought it up earlier, you brought him up earlier with a lusty voice of hatred, Andre Ward. Basically, what had happened was I had, a little bit earlier today was that I read that on Boxing Scene that Ryan Macignana had interviewed Andre Ward, and the tagline for the article was something along the lines of, Andre Ward says, if I beat Sergey Kovalev, then what? And so essentially what Andre Ward was saying in the article was that the money is at 168 pounds, but nobody there wants to fight him. That basically he's saying, I don't want to move up to light heavyweight because the money's here, but nobody wants to fight me. So in any event, I just wanted to kind of touch on that if you know, you wouldn't mind. But to me, it seems that, I mean, Andre Ward isn't fighting, period. He's not fighting. So it doesn't even really matter where the money's at. And even when he was fighting, he wasn't being, you know, particularly active. And, you know, past all of his style, past the in-ring stuff, past all of that, he clearly has an overly inflated sense of self-worth here. And, you know, not a whole lot of people give a shit about whether or not he fight, while Kovalev's name is obviously growing. And, you know, he's kind of creating a bit of a brand for himself. And, you know, because Kovalev's name is growing, you know, the size of, you know, whatever, and my pants is also growing because it's Sergey Kovalev. But to answer the question, you know, after Kovalev, you know, fight Kovalev at light heavyweight, but don't then, you know, don't weigh in at light heavyweight and then go back to 168 pounds or something, you know, like do what fighters do. So do you have an opinion on this, James Foley?
Yeah, I mean, the best thing that HBO ever did was getting rid of Andre Ward and replacing him full-time again with Roy Jones. Because what's awesome about it is, like, even though Roy probably, like, doesn't prepare at all for the broadcasts,
he's just so much better than Andre Ward was. I honestly, like, as a commentator, he was so, so bad. So I don't care if he wants to fight Scrubs at 168 or whatever, as long as he doesn't ever try to take, you know, get into commentating again, I'm fine with whatever he chooses to do.
You know, we've actually both been a little bit more favorable towards Andre Ward than a lot of people seem to be. And I mean, we haven't even been particularly complimentary towards the guy. I'm not a huge fan. I know that you're not a really big fan. But even so, you know, we've kind of begrudgingly given
him I used to be a fan. I used to be a fan.
Well, before I knew him. He makes it difficult to be a fan. He makes it difficult in the ring
a
lot of the time, and he makes it difficult out of the ring because he comes off like a total dickhead.
Well, you know, I enjoy watching him fight to a degree. I mean, I really enjoyed the fight with Kessler and with Frotch a lot because I think those are really good opponents, and to see what he was able to do with them was very, you know, exciting and interesting to watch. The same way that, you know, Floyd Mayweather kind of, in his style, is fun to watch without there being that much kind of back and forth action. But you make a good point. I mean, I think it's fine to just be the man in your division and fight all challengers in your division if that's you want to be that guy. I mean, we can't be hypocrite. You know, if there's a fighter we liked was doing it, we would defend him. You know, if Kovalev wants to camp at 175 and be that guy, I'm not going to. I mean, okay, it's a little different, I guess, with like light heavy to cruiserweight, but. Point being that, like, you know, I'm not going to tell a guy that I like that he has to move up. So, I mean, I think some of this is because, like, we don't like Andre Ward. That said, just don't try to claim some kind of, like, historical greatness. That's the main point. Don't avoid, you know, challenges that are realistic to make that could make you a better, you know. And obviously, beating Kovalev would be huge. It wouldn't be as huge, but I don't think there's a mandate for that. I mean, like, let's face it, beating Adonis Stevenson would be bigger than beating Kovalev, right? Because that would make him the lineal champion, the same way that we celebrated, you know, Cotto. So, and beating Hopkins would kind of have something, you know. Kovalev is not really a big name. He's I love the guy, but to suggest that Ward like should have to go to 175 and fight him, it doesn't. I think there's other guys who actually have ducked Kovalev, you know, like Stevenson. So I don't know, like this particular thing, I mean, it's just like people don't like Ward, so everything he does, it's going to be kind of questionable. But I think as far as like, he's already beaten the best guys at 168. I guess eventually maybe, a great middleweight will come up. Maybe it'll be Golovkin, you know, somebody can come up and give him, another test there. But for now, I mean, if he wants to try to, you know, enhance his legacy, I mean, those fights are at 175. It's just whether it's Stevenson, whether it's Kovalev. I mean, you factor in the economic stuff, and, like, Kovalev doesn't really make that much sense right off the bat. But, you know, that is what he should do, I guess, if he wants to, like, kind of make a claim at historical greatness right at this moment, because he's basically already vanquished all the challengers in his own division.
Well, and I mean, okay, you do have a point, and I do think that it's a relevant point. Some of this might be and probably is because we're not big Andre Ward fans and that it is kind of popular to not like him, right? Right. We can agree on that. But, you know, aside from the in-the-ring stuff, you know, there have been fights where I was like, oh, okay, I can get into this. You know, him dominating Chad Dawson and looking, you know, respectable in the meantime, you know, respectably entertaining. The fight with Saki Obiega, while it was dirty, it was still kind of fun. You know, it was a version of Andre Ward that was like, you know, he was willing to kind of war it out, and that was cool. A lot of the other time, it's not very exciting for me. But even putting that aside, you know, just looking at like the kind of outside the ring aspect and how he approaches boxing, I think that it's something that it just doesn't really make him a whole lot of fans. You know, because he is coming from the perspective that he is a superstar, and especially in this interview that I had brought up, with Ryan Macignana, in the interview, basically he's saying the Kovalev fight isn't pay-per-view. So since it's not pay-per-view, then what am I going to do? It's like, dude, how many fucking pay-per-view fights do you think you have, bro? How many who the fuck is going to pay for you? Who's fucking paying $50, $60, $70 to see you? Nobody. Nobody's going to do
that.
He sells well, like, in Oakland. You know, like, when he fights in Oakland, he can sell pretty decently. Apart from that, nobody gives a shit. So to see him coming from that standpoint, that's annoying.
Dude, I'm with you. I think that Ward has been kind of overrated because he's dominated a division, and that's awesome. And we got to respect anybody who cleans out a division like that. But it wasn't really a great division relative to a lot of the talent that was, like, beneath that. You know, and so I felt like when guys started just, you know, when guys were moving him up into, like, making him the number 2 pound-for-pound fighter, when you had, you know, Pacquiao and Marquez competing against each other at this really high level, you know, you had guys, even like a Sergio Martinez, to, you know, at one point, Nonito Donaire. I mean, I didn't think Ward vaulted himself ahead of those guys the way so many other people did. But I think that, you know, because he's been elevated to that status, I mean, on HBO, they're calling him the best fighter in the world. You know, that's what they said. And then later was amended to, like, oh, in his weight class. But, no, Kellerman clearly was implying that, like, Ward's the best fighter in the world. Like, basically right neck and neck with Mayweather is the best fighter in the world. And that's been the message. And, I don't know. I mean, he still has never really met a truly great fighter on his level, you know. And Frotch was probably the closest thing to it. It's a great win. But I think in his mind, this is where he's at now. He thinks he's now he's entitled to, like, that kind of pay-per-view fight. And, hey, the market will determine that, you know, not us. I mean, if he gets a fight with Chavez and maybe that goes on pay-per-view, and we'll see. But I don't think he's there. I mean, I wouldn't pay, you know, if he fought Golovkin, I would pay for that, and I would encourage people to pay for that. I think that's a great fight. It's better when Golovkin gets more names on his resume. And then, like you said, I mean, going up and fighting one of the great big light heavyweights, but I'd kind of rather that situation gets resolved with Stevenson and Kovalev and Ward moves up to fight, like, a really legitimate champion up there, you know, and then that's a big fight that I will pay for. But he's deluded to think that, like, him fighting, you know, Chavez is going to resonate with boxing fans more than fighting, you know, taking on a real great threat.
Yeah,
and I think Chavez has his fan base, but that's not a fight we're gonna, you know.
Well, and you know that would be a good fight. That, you know, that's a fight that I would totally see, and I'd have no problem with that fight, even with Chavez maybe
with
being
Chavez,
a little bit overestimated.
I'm down
there,
with it. I'm down with
but
that
still,
fight. But it's Ward's the B side. You know, Ward is the B side on that fight. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
What I'm saying.
And,
I mean, he's not.
And
we're not paying
then,
for Andre
you know,
Ward.
Yeah, and even then, looking into the, you know, the reality of that fight even being made is that Andre Ward's in litigation with his promoter, and then Chavez Jr. isn't in a real good position with his promoter either. So that fight is unlikely to – point is, anyway, is just that Andre Ward doesn't have quite as many options as the way he acts, is all I'm saying. And that makes him just seem kind of, like, unattractive from being a fan standpoint, you know. Anyway.
Well, the super middleweight, the super six tournament on Showtime, I mean, it was kind of a unique thing. It gave a bigger platform to that division, and it gave more spotlight, you know, because, you know, in the U.S., I mean, it's traditionally super middleweight hasn't really been like a big money division here, you know. I mean, so I think that because of the exposure, I think that it kind of led some people to kind of overrate some of those fighters. I mean, I just think welterweight and the area around Mayweather and Pacquiao is more talented. And, you know, I think that Ward being thrust up into the pound for pound, he benefited greatly from kind of being an underdog. And I mean, the Kessler and Frost, they were great wins. I still think that Dawson was kind of a fluky, weird thing when you ask a guy to move at his age and his experience level to move down 7 pounds. It's a bigger deal than what, you know.
Yeah.
I don't believe that was an honest knockout on even terms, you know, and I never will. I mean, Dawson didn't go down. He's fought other fighters, never went down like that. And then a Ward, who doesn't really have power compared to, you know, drops him 3 times, is a classic weight drained guy who didn't have his balance. And I can't make it like a huge win. And that, you know, that's, again, it's like, had they fought a half pound higher, we could be calling Andre Ward the light heavyweight champion of the world.
Yeah, it's stupid.
whatever.
Well, actually, Matt Swain just tweeted that Andre Ward's douchedom is biblical in scale, which was a nice pun considering Ward so biblical himself. But
I mean, like, he's a great fighter for this era. He's one of the best fighters in the sport. It's just kind of like, you know, his attitude's gotten a little bit from a lot of his public comments have been kind of grating, you know, and that's all. And you can't look in his division. I mean, you really can't knock the guy. I don't think anyone else in the whole sport has a situation where they've beaten every belt holder in the division. You know, I mean, that's pretty impressive. And if you look through the rankings, top 10 at super middleweight, I think Ward's probably has wins over 7 of those guys. So, you know, mad credit for that. But why are you, talking smack about Kovalev?
Yeah.
You fucking pussy.
Well, obviously, I brought the whole thing up so that we could just spend about 10 to 15 minutes talking shit about Andre Ward, because, you know, that was basically my aim from the outset. Because we hate
ever,
Andre Ward.
Don't ever say his name.
Don't bring it up. Well, here then, before we have like a little over 5 minutes left, so let me get in, if you don't mind, one little last little piece of news that I thought was important. So a purse bid for Carlos Molina versus Cornelius Bundridge had been scheduled. So I just wanted to say that I thought that was relevant because I'm going to throw out the first bid. I bid my broken iPhone headbuds and, you know, the all the lint in my pocket. Opening bid. What do you think?
I can't match that. Yeah, that might be the worst, stylistically, like the most terrible fight that I could imagine. I mean, well, we saw Carlos Molina against Corey Spinks, and then you saw the Spinks-Bundridge fight, which actually was much better than the Molina fight. But, you know, you throw in Molina into the mix, and, yeah, that's
kind of brutal.
That's going to be pretty brutal. But, dude, how the hell what happened to Molina? I thought I heard he was in prison for, like, 10 years, and now he's in Mexico, and he's getting fights.
That's, believe it or not, exactly why I friggin' brought that up. Now, all jokes aside, you know, and I'm not trying to make light of whatever it was that happened with Molina. I don't know. I wasn't there, blah, blah, blah. Point is that he got, you know, extradited on some, like, you know, sex charge. But now all of a sudden, because he's with Al Haymon, perhaps, it's like, you know, the purse bids and, like, you know, just a month or two ago, they were talking about, is he ever, like, going to ever fight again? Now, like, he's got the purse bid thing going because he's aligned with Al Haymon. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, you know, the Charlo brothers thought it was all a conspiracy because they were trying to make Molina against Canelo. So he ducked out of that fight with Charlo, like, right before. They thought the whole thing was – they said that on Twitter.
Twin conspiracy.
I don't know, but, you know, I was kind of defending Molina at first and then found out some more details about the case, and it was, like, a little bit more unsavory than what I thought. But, you know, I mean, it was a long time ago. But I think the biggest issue is that he was basically deported because of it and wasn't even, like, legally supposed to be in the United States. So I had heard that they were actually going to, like, throw the book at him and that was, like, a felony to be here illegally, and they're going to put him in, you know, for – and he was – he was in, like, the INS holding cell for a couple days, and then kind of just out of nowhere, the next report was, like, Carlos Molina is, like, released to Mexico, and now he's going to, like, continue his boxing career.
Yeah. And
you know, I don't know. I mean,
he never seemed
like a real
serious bad
guy, but it did at the time. It seemed like he was, like, totally fucked, and now he's back, but I guess he can't come to the U.S., and he'll probably never be able to come to the United States.
That's the Bundridge effect.
Yeah, corny Bundridge is going to have to go to Mexico.
Total corny Bundridge effect, man.
Hopefully Floyd Mayweather won't be at ringside. Again, you know? Grinding on his...
That's the first... Yeah, that's like one of the first thoughts I had is, great, dude, Floyd's going to be there totally disrespecting his wife again. Great.
Yeah, well, Mayweather loves Mexico.
What's that?
I said, Mayweather loves Mexico. That's a Mayweather
quote.
True. of himself in the third person.
Yeah,
I've heard
him
say that
true.
A few hundred times.
Well, we have about a minute left, so that was a good show. It was a decent show. We had Raskin on. We, you know, said some stupid shit after he left. It was good stuff. Well, let's see. We'll probably be coming back next week, I guess. I guess kind of depending on what goes on during, you know, next weekend and what we got
we'll
coming
check,
up. But
we'll
either
check
way,
Rayfield's blog and then let you guys know.
I'll grab a little Skype with Glazer. We'll see what happens.
You can talk
but,
to him, Rick.
Yeah. Everybody who tuned in, thanks so much for tuning in. And also thank you again to Eric Raskin for joining us. And again, go check out his book, Moneymaker Effect, on Amazon or wherever it is you buy books. We would appreciate that. And check him out on Ring Theory, his podcast. Again, thanks everybody for joining us. Check out badlefthook.com for Foley stuff, queensberryrules.com for my stuff. We will see you next week. Thanks again. Take it easy.